tell you, positive vibes. 90.3 FM. Every Thursday, 1-3 to 5. Lady D, go and pick up myself and see. Will they not again?
Love it when you're quiet, panic, quiet, panic.
KUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on www.ckut.ca on the World Wide Web. News, interviews, and music featuring the voices of prisoners, their allies, and supporters. Tune into the Prison Radio Show on the fourth Friday of every month between 11 a.m. and noon, and every second Thursday of the month between 5 and 6 p.m. To get involved in Prison Radio, or if you need to access past programs, email prison@ckut.ca.
Yes, rehabilitation.
I wonder if you know what the word means. Do you? It comes from the Latin root habilis. The definition is to invest again with dignity. You consider that part of your job, Harvey, to give a man back the dignity he once had? Your only interest is in how he behaves. You'll conform to our ideas of how you should behave.
I am not a number. I am a free man.
You were a number. You weren't a man. You want to be a human. I wasn't Jim Crow, and hell, I was number 586.
Why do you do a warder's job?
It's a good job. Responsible job. Officers like myself trying to...
Scum.
We're only enforcing the law.
The law. When they hang my husband, is that just...
Good evening and welcome to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm Virginia and I'll be your host for today. We have a bit of an unconventional show for you today. It contains no new interviews and none of the audio comes directly from us. Instead, we wanted to share with you the story of Dacajuia, also known as Splitting the Sky, also known as John Boncour or John Boncour Hill. Dacajuia, or Dac as he was known to his friends, was a Ganyan Kehaka man born in 1952 in Buffalo, New York. He was thrown in prison at 18 after being homeless and starving on the streets of Buffalo, and he ended up in Attica in 1971. He was transferred there a few months before the uprising that made Attica famous, and he ended up facing legal retaliation for his participation in the uprising. His story and the stories he intertwines with Attica make very clear the connections between prisons and colonialism in the U.S. and Canada. This first clip we want to share with you is from a talk he gave at a conference called Breaking the Chains that happened in Seattle in the early 2000s. In this clip, he talks about getting politicized at Attica, meeting people like Sam Melville, who was a white settler who was imprisoned for bombing a number of buildings in New York City before joining the Weather Underground and participating and then being killed in the Attica uprising. Here's that clip.
I read that Prairie Fire manual and was totally inspired by what was in that manual. I was totally inspired by that manual because one of the weathermen was right there in a cell next to me by the name of Sam Melville. He was known as the Mad Bomber. He was right next to me and became one of my political mentors. He started talking to me every day. He started educating me about what was going on in this capitalist society and the necessity to begin to undermine the state. And the tactics that they used, the Weather Underground, Marilyn Buck, and the rest of the Resistance Six, and what they had begun to do to undermine the capitalist structure and began to define economics to me and began to let me see that I was actually a victim and not a criminal. I was a victim of a criminal system. And he began to open my eyes some more. Another set of books was given me to by another brother. And they were written by George Jackson, a prisoner, a black political prisoner in San Quentin. And in the book, I read Blood in My Eyes. And then I read letters from George Jackson. And that book was going all over the prison population. By this time, there was a great antisocial movement happening. There was the rise of the Black Panther Party. There was the Black Liberation Army, the Puerto Rican Liberation Army, the women's group, the women's movement was getting very powerful. There was the anti-war movement. Before you know it, all of these people were coming in as political prisoners, prisoners of conscience, and they were starting to educate us who didn't know, who didn't understand, and we began to create cells to teach one another what was going on in this world, to reconnect ourselves to who we are as human beings. And so after reading George Jackson's books, I was totally inflamed by what he wrote, because he spoke to my anger. He spoke to my need to grab that capitalist system like a bull and grab it by the horns and turn it and twist it until you snap its neck. And he was such a powerful motivator in my life. And then one day, we heard that George Jackson had went on a visit, and that the guards in the prison said that George Jackson had an afro, and inside of his afro was a .38 snub nose, and he was plotting to escape with that .38, and so they shot and killed him 19 times. They shot him and murdered George Jackson. At that time, you could not congregate more than three people without getting basically bludgeoned to death for defining an order inside a prison. We decided to just say to hell with that, because many of us were given the label of being militants, because we were constantly engaging, fighting, and going to solitary confinement and being tortured when we went to solitary confinement. So when this happened to George Jackson, everybody unanimously came out to the yard and we all did a prayer. We put black armbands around our white shirts and we had 10 minutes of silence in prayer unanimously for the spirit and the respect of George Jackson.
With that brief setup, we wanted to get straight into the story of the Attica Rebellion itself. The audio that comes next was recently aired on The Brief podcast, but is from 2004 when Dacajuea was on tour giving speeches across Canada. This is from a talk he gave in Nova Scotia with some setup from the hosts of The Brief podcast. Again, we'll link to the original sources of all of this audio in our show notes, which you can find online at prisonradioshow.libsyn.com. So here's the hosts of The Brief. They have just finished up an interview with Heather Ann Thompson, who wrote a Pulitzer Prize-winning book about Attica. The hosts sum up some of the findings from talking to Thompson and then get straight into an introduction to Dacajuea. For those of you just tuning in, today we're sharing the story of Dacajuea or Splitting the Sky. Specifically at this point, the story is about the Attica Uprising in which he took part. This is the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. Here are the hosts of The Brief.
So after all that, there's no ambiguity about how these prisoners or the guards died, right?
There's no ambiguity. For the record, the prisoners had no guns. That should be fairly obvious.
Yeah.
There's no question here. The bullets that were fired that killed all prisoners and all guards were fired by the state. And another element that this that we should bring in, too, is that the way that this operation went down was, instead of it being run by, say, the National Guard, the operation was run essentially out of the back of a truck. They drove up a truck full of guns and gave to basically volunteer corrections officers that had come, like veterans from other prison uprisings that were pissed about what happened in those prison uprisings, all kind of joined, like left their prisons and went and volunteered to take part in this operation with no training for this kind of operation of any kind. They were given guns out of the back of a truck. They were not tagged. They were not logged. So nobody knew who had what gun, who fired what bullets. There was nothing like accountability. This was going to be a massacre. It was going to be a massacre the whole time.
And not just that, it was also an expression of extremist white supremacy. I mean, the cops and the corrections officers went there with the intent to massacre black people. And you can hear that in the clip that we have right here.
Good evening. The four-day insurrection at New York's Attica State Prison came to a tragic end this morning.
Negotiations gave way to force, making this the bloodiest prison incident the country has seen in four decades.
So those are prison guards that you're hearing on the outside of the prison after the operation saying, that's white power, that's white power. Because, of course, in the yard, fists were up, people were chanting black power. It's important to note, just to put a fine point on the level of savagery of this massacre. This was not necessary to take back control of the prison. In many cases, the deaths happened after the prison was subdued. People were executed like L.D. Barkley. He was executed, according to his medical examiner report, he was shot from behind at close range after the prison had been subdued. So they went around looking for the people they perceived as leaders and executed them. They shot into people's foxholes that they were hiding in. They executed people that were cowering in the corners, young, old, people who had nothing to do with it. It was really just an unmitigated massacre.
Right. It was revenge. And it was also to make sure that these heroes of the uprising weren't regarded as heroes in their communities when they got released. It was a total massacre, and nobody has ever been held to account.
The only person charged for murder in the Attica prison uprising was our guest who's coming next. Splitting the Sky is a Mohawk warrior from upstate New York. This interview was recorded in Halifax, Pierre, myself, and our friend Chris in July 2004, actually. And we spent a week in Nova Scotia with Splitting the Sky. And he was driving around giving fiery speeches about his place on the front lines of some of the most memorable struggles in the United States and Canada. Splitting the Sky was a leader at the Gustavson Lake standoff in 1995, which was an Indigenous Canadian state standoff that lasted for more than a month. And the Canadian government used helicopters, armored personnel carriers, improvised explosive devices, and more than 77,000 rounds of ammunition during the standoff. Let's hear from Doc.
Others of us that were coming in that weren't really politically conscious when we came in, you know, we're beginning to become politically conscious, and then we started meeting. Like, for instance, I always tell people, when I first went to Attica, I met a brother by the name of Sam Melville. He belonged to the George Jackson Brigade, and as well as the Weather Underground. He was known as the Mad Bomber. And so he would start telling me about, you know, how the Weather Underground had been blowing up different military installations and corporate buildings, and how they started talking about the revolutions in Cuba, the revolution in Algiers, and started, you know, and just going around the world and started introducing us to this. So this was all orally done. But it was always said. And it would even write, like Sam Melville would write a lot of stuff, type it up, and then we'd fold it up and we'd have to hide it underneath the poles in our beds and keep it under there and put the cap on so that if they come down, if they find this kind of it's considered contraband. Anything to do with political consciousness, right, or revolutionary material. So whenever they found that, you would be brutalized and thrown in solitary confinement, and they killed with impunity inside the penitentiary, I'm telling you. Now, one of the main revolutionary leaders during that time that many of us were just like totally inspired by was George Jackson. He was one of the Soledad brothers in California, and he was in San Quentin Prison. And many of us had gotten his books. And many of the books we couldn't have in hard for because it was too hard to hide. So a lot of times people would mimeograph this stuff and bring it in. You had some guards that were sympathetic, you know what I mean? And basically decent, half-assed decent people. And they would bring in some material, and they would bring in stuff that would be censored. One day on August the 16th, 1971, we heard that they had killed George Jackson in San Quentin. And that was like, you know, it was like all of a sudden, everybody in the yard, black, white, Puerto Rican, Indian, came together and held a memorial service in complete defiance to the guards. Now, the guards came out up on the catwalks with guns and pointed them into the yard. And they said, disperse, disperse. And everybody said, to hell with you. Everybody stood there, and everybody was there. You know, the Muslims were making a prayer to honor him. The revolutionaries, the Black Panthers, everybody was there, said, to hell with the state. And basically stood there and said a prayer, and then we dispersed. But when we did that, we tasted our own power in that solidarity. And it was a moment of solidarity. It was like, okay. Then there was another incident that happened a week later. There was a black brother and a white brother out in the yard. They were scrimmaging for a football game. And this lieutenant came out into the yard with a bunch of guards. The guards went to grab him, and the black brother turned around and said, "Man, you ain't locking me up." Right? And then when they went to grab him, because they were scrimmaging for a football game, but they were saying they were fighting. So the black brother, by the name of Leroy Dewar, turned around and punched the guard, the lieutenant, right in the face. Popped him in the face again, and all these guards going at him, and all of a sudden it was just instantaneous. 400 inmates, all colors, just got up and circled all those guards. That was spontaneous. It was just as if it was a spontaneous move. So when we circled around him, and the lieutenant got thoroughly scared, the guards were like wide-eyed. They came out with the guns up on top, but we had them surrounded, so they didn't want to shoot into the yard. And so what happened was, they finally dispersed. Everybody went back in. They promised not to lock those two guys up. Then we went back to our cells. That night, they pulled the other two brothers out of their cells. The next morning, we go into the mess hall. The word was, the prison grapevine was, "Hey, this could be it. The shit's going to hit the fan today." Point blank. So, but we just knew. Now, this wasn't a pre-organized thing. This is happening by the day, but so many years of being oppressed. It's just like, and everybody thinking, this is spontaneous. What'll happen when 1,200 oppressed men come together in this kind of situation, and all of a sudden, spontaneously, it was just time, like, to see how much, what could be chaos and how quickly chaos turned into organized revolutionary organization. And so here we are. The next morning, we walk out the cells. We go into the mess hall. And the word was, everybody fast, take no food. Right? And the 1,200 men, we went into the mess hall. Nobody ate except the diabetics. Now it's perfect quiet. The only thing you hear now, 100 guards against the walls with the keys. They're so damn scared, you can hear his keys shaking. It was like we could smell their fear. And it was just like a total collective empowering. Black, white, yellow, red. It was just complete unity and a complete empowering at that moment. We started walking back down the hall. When you get out of mess hall, you go out to the yard before you go to your slave assignments in industry. But the doors were closed. So when we stopped in the hallway, and when the captain and a bunch of guards comes walking down the hall, one of the brothers, a Black Panther brother, said, how come those brothers got locked up last night? And before you knew it, the place just jumped. All of a sudden, you got 1,200 men in four different blocks moving through, grabbing sticks, grabbing pipes, pulling out shanks from everywhere. Everybody's strapped up, got shanks, start grabbing prison guards as hostages. Grab these guys, we started stripping them out of their clothes, their prison clothes, and put them in inmate clothes so that if they're going to assault us, they're not going to know who's who. So we put them in inmate clothes so they look just like us. When we went down to the middle of there was all the four quarters come together. So right there, that's where all the gates and the halls converge. There's guards on the inside that control the gates. So one, different cell blocks, they have to open up the gate, close the gate when they go through, and then open up another. So they got full control at that point. The guards that were in there were four of them, they were scared out of their mind. They didn't want to open those gates, and we had to liberate the whole prison. Right now, it's just a block, the block we were in, that was totally liberated, and the rest of everybody, you can see them on the other sides, and everybody's moving and rebelling, but we can't get through that gate. So all of a sudden, about 30 of us, well, maybe 30 to 60 of us, at any given time, this cast iron gate, the width of maybe 20 feet wide, that was encased in bricks. We kept pulling, shaking this gate. And all of a sudden, this gate just ripped right out of the brick walls. We just pulled it right out of the brick walls, and it collapsed, went down, hit one of the guards in the head, killed the guard. 2 days later, he died.
But they accused me of killing this cop because I'm the one that yelled, take this place. So I was indicted for his alleged murder down the road. Then we seized the penitentiary when we opened it up. We took everybody into the prison yard, D block. We held the place with 50 hostages. And we instantaneously mobilized a coalition of men from every revolutionary group, every Muslim group, every body, every organization, or everybody had a representative on the negotiating team. We demanded immediately to be able to bring the outside media in, and the guy by the name of Russell G. Oswald, for the first time in history, granted that. That was their mistake. CBC, ABC, NBC, all the major networks were in there. New York Times, everybody. When they came in, the camera was on the inside for the first time in history. That was unheard of. Then we negotiated for 5 days, and then we had observers like Senator John Dunn, Tom Wicker from the New York Times, Bill Kunstler, the famous civil rights attorney, came in. Representatives from the Puerto Rican Liberation Party, the Black Panther Party, Bobby Seals came in to observe the negotiations between ourselves and the state of New York. Now, Russell G. Oswald was the main negotiator with us, and he was coming in and out. But there were other state negotiators that were coming in. And the thing about it was, is we began to negotiate for changes in the prison system. More money for our wages, better living conditions, an upgrade of the per capita instead of 62 cents a day to eat. But then some of us who were becoming more militant, revolutionary minded and more militant were saying, like, the hell with making a terrible situation sweeter. Some of us said, hey, we want complete amnesty from any criminal prosecution. We want the immediate removal of those of us who are political prisoners. We want to be taken from this prison in a helicopter, and we want to go to a country, a non-imperialist country. And we had 17 countries in the world said that they would take us. Palestinians said they would take us. The Soviets said that they would take us. Cuba said that they would take us. Angola said that they would take us. We had revolutionaries. Vietnamese said that they would take us in and give us political asylum in a minute. So now the whole world is seeing Attica. But it's very important to understand what happened next. That morning it was lightly raining. There was a light mist. We had been up all night long, and somebody, we just kind of knew something was going down. We had all our little fire camps going. It was intense, the emotions. It was like we were crying. We knew it was coming down. We could feel it. And here we are where we're like crying. One brother said to me, he was crying. I says, and he was an older black brother. And I says, man, I said, brother, I said, what's the matter with you? And he said, man, brother, he said, you know, he said, this is the first time I've seen the stars in 32 years. Profusely crying. And it made me cry. And it just a welling of emotions, you know, because everybody was doing this, you know, and it was like, all of a sudden, we see 1,000 state troopers up on the walls, up on top of the prison. They got these red fluorescent raincoats on. They got gas masks on. Then all of a sudden, we hear this thunderous sound of an army helicopter flying over. They dropped this big canister of CN4 gas. And it's a gas that was banned by the Geneva Convention of 1906. For cruel and unusual pain and suffering in the lungs and the eyes, but they used it on us. So the whole yard is saturated with this gas. Now the media is outside saying, reporting as fact, that we had sliced hostages' throats, decapitated hostages, and castrated them. But eventually, the forensic expert in Rochester, in a press conference after the massacre, said that absolutely no guard had been cut with a knife at all. That everyone died as a result of state bullets. They had every kind of assault weapon you could possibly think of, including a 270 elephant rifle. And they fired 15,000 rounds of bullets into the yard. 43 people were killed, murdered in cold blood. I watched people's screaming, people's faces being blown off, guts spilling, and they're yelling with the gas masks as they're coming in, shotguns. One brother was holding up a Black Liberation flag. They shot him so many times, he just stood there. He wouldn't even fall. They put 200 rounds of bullets in him. And then they only fell when the bullets stopped. So 43 people got killed. 80 people were wounded and maimed there for life. Attica, what it empowered. It re-empowered the oppressed. Because, I mean, for years after that, I mean, we got bold. Prisoners, all prisoners used to say, the cops fuck with them. Yeah, you motherfuckers, what you want, another Attica, motherfucker? That's the word. Because you will get another Attica. It empowered people to say, hey, fuck you. Fuck you and your system. And then, you know, I mean, when even Black September, they had a big sign out there, so remember Attica. You know, I mean, all over the world, people said, Attica, Attica, Attica is all of us. Attica means fight back. It became a major axiom, posters and so, all over the world. Nobody died in vain. No, no. Because you know what we did? At that point, it was a 20th century slave rebellion of the oppressed, of all colors, of all walks of life, including the white working class. It was a phenomenal revolution. It was a big sacrifice, but it was not in vain. Because here we are, and we're still talking about it. It's history that's not going to go away. It's just not going to go away. Attica is all of us. Attica means fight back.
This is the Prison Radio Show, coming to you straight from the CKUT radio station, located in the beautiful city of Montreal. Though we are always fighting for prisoners' rights through our news, guest interviews, and opinion pieces, a personal, heartfelt shout-out of love and support to our brothers and sisters suffering behind bars can raise hope in a weary soul. And not only those within our 200-kilometer broadcasting area, but anyone who has access to our uploaded shows on www.ckut.ca or on CKUT 90.3 FM SoundCloud or on Prison Radio WordPress blog. We're worldwide, people. Never forget, you are not alone. We always have you in our thoughts and actions. Stay strong and keep the faith.
As Dacajuea's story makes very clear, there were lots of connections being made in the 1970s between prisoner struggles, Black liberation struggles, Puerto Rican independence movement struggles, indigenous struggles, and the mostly white anti-imperialist underground. We don't often hear about direct connections between indigenous land defense struggles and struggles like the uprising in Attica, so I wanted to share these clips where Dacajuea is making an explicit connection between these two things. First, in a story about the Onondaga Nation's struggle against New York State's attempt to expand the size of Interstate 81 through their territory, and second, through the story of the reoccupation of Ganyenke by Mohawks in 1974. First, though, I want to set these stories up by sharing a clip from Dacajuea's talk in Buffalo at the bookstore Burning Books in 2011. In the first clip, he talks about his views on justice and accountability. That clip is followed by the stories connecting the Attica Rebellion to the Onondaga struggle and the struggle at Ganyenke.
I'm not trying to make prison a better place for me to live. Prison is a cage. And I believe there's something bigger and better in the human condition. I believe if you look at our Ongwe people, if you look at our Six Nations, Iroquois people, And if you look at our traditional nations, and if you look at the models that we have for collective ownership of the land, and collective ownership of the resources, and collective ownership of the right to every human being to have a home, to have a good standard of living. Many of us live in poverty. Yes, that's true. But in the meantime, for the most part, there is a collective will amongst our people to try to help one another in our communities. And if we, I don't know, there may be some jails on some reserves, as they're called. We like to call ours independent sovereign nations, self-determining nations. But we have our peacekeepers that try to keep the peace when the peace is broken within the community. But we don't send people to jail for life, or nor do we send them to a place to sit until we execute them. It doesn't happen that way. There is a better way. And this other way is alien to us. And so now we're just dealing with this dynamic. So that morning, as a result of that particular incident, and the fact that we held hostages for 50 hostages for 5 days, but we negotiated very, very strategically for a better way while we were there. We were negotiating for changes in the penal system.
You're listening to the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are in the middle of sharing clips from Dacajuia, or Splitting the Skies, talk at Burning Books Buffalo in 2011 about connections between the Attica Uprising and Indigenous land defense actions in the 1970s. Here's some more.
D-Squad of the state troopers that went in and killed 43 people and wounded 80 people and maimed it for life at Attica. Well, believe it or not, earlier that morning, they were on their way up. They were originally given the orders to go up to Highway 81. There was a major standoff going off between the Onondaga Indians, my Mohawk people, the Ganyangihawas, from Canada and the U.S., both sides, were down 800 strong, and the Oneidas were armed, ready to defend Highway 81 at Onondaga, to stop the bulldozing and the proposed expanding of the highway through sovereign Indian Mohawk Onondaga territory, Iroquois territory. There was a defensive stand. Those same guards, those same state troopers that went out to Attica, that came into Attica, are the same ones that were headed for Onondaga, and then they were turned around and sent in to kill us. Many people told me afterwards, one fellow told me, a medicine man told me, that a drum in the longhouse started playing an honor song by itself. And the people in there knew that the people that died in Attica died, gave their lives for Six Nations people to survive and live. Something happened that day. Very powerful. And it's not the last time it happened like that. It also happened in the same way at Ginyonge in 1974, Moss Lake. Because I went up there while I was on trial. I wasn't supposed to be up there, but I went up there, and 400 of us over there making an armed stance in defense of that land. We defended that land because they stole that land, and an incident came up, and I just have to footnote. I have to footnote this because it's all unbelievably related. That land was stolen by the Rockefellers, the same one that ordered the massacre at Attica. That land was 400 acres of land up in Moss Lake. And Alan, it was that lake, was it 400 acres? Do you remember up there in Moss Lake? It was 400. And there was a number of us. It was a Girl Scout camp, but they were no longer there, so we used those cabins, right? We got bunkered out up there when we took that land back. Now, what happened was there was an incident where there was a shootout, and some of these rednecks were shooting into the camp. And nobody knew who was in the cars, and there was return fire, and it just so happened there was a 9-year-old girl in there. Now, why would anybody take, you know, be shooting in a car with a 9-year-old girl into a camp? Because I obviously going to shoot back. Young girl gets hurt, all of a sudden there's state troopers coming. Now, we're all up there, and we're on a regular alert. Michelle was up there. come up. We used to drive up there, right, Michelle? She had an old car. It was in the snow, and we had the windshield wipers. We had to have, like, two strings going like this, right? And, you know, Porter, remember that station wagon? Jeez! I mean, we had that's how we kept the snow off the windows. We had to keep pulling those ropes back and forth like that. You remember that, Alicia? Yeah, that was what we call a resmobile. Right? The res bomb. Well, we took it, we got there. I was told I wasn't even supposed to be up there. I wasn't supposed to have arms on me, but I again went up there, still angry. Still angry, young man, still a fighter, and ready to go the distance. But now I'm up there on the weekends, but it just so happens that weekend when that incident happened, it just so happens all of a sudden there is a line. There was hundreds of cars, state troopers' cars coming up, and it was just getting dusk, and that all those lights looked like a big serpent snake crawling up that hill, coming up way up to Moss Lake there. And people were all prepared, camouflaged in sheets, hose, little trees and guns, camouflaged on the side. No pointed hats. There was no, we didn't have the pointed ones. We just had the ones that lay flat on the head. But when they came up, strategically, they came right into our checkpoint. They came right into our space. And eventually people just said, surprise, boom, compromised. The state troopers just happened to be the same ones that went in and killed everybody in Attica. Now, it would have been easy to have a vendetta, but we showed diplomacy. We showed humanity. We never identified ourselves, of course, but we let them know you've been compromised. There's nothing you can do. The head of the state police said, hey, whoa, and he was part of Mohawk and part Irish. And he called back to Hugh Carey, who succeeded Rockefeller, and he told Hugh Carey, he says, we have a situation here. We've been totally compromised, and if these guys want to, they could kill hundreds of us right now. We're dead. Hugh Carey said, you turn those vehicles around, get them out of there right now, because I don't want Ginyange to become my Attica. Next, that's a victory. They left. They turned around and left. And then I remember talking with Louis Hall and others when he was alive. And I said, and Louis said, when they first decided that they were going to go in, when they held the council, and when they held that council, but when they held that council, they said, a lot of people said, well, you know, this would be a really good time to go in and make the move to go up to Ginyange. And a lot of guys said, no, it's not a good thing to go up. Because look what they did to the brothers of Attica. They said, well, yeah, well, this is why they won't do it again. So that's why they decided to take Ginyange. Well, after that incident, they got compromised. Mario Cuomo, his lieutenant governor, came up and said, look, we'll trade you 7,000 acres of land for 50,000 acres of land further up near Dannemora. And today, they trade it off, and today there's the 7th permanent settlement of the Ginyange people.
I think this story about Ginyange is important, and Dakajuea told the story slightly different each time he told it. To that end, I wanted to share another version of him telling the same story, this one from the Breaking the Chains conference in Seattle in the early 2000s.
I happened to get involved with 400 Mohawk warriors, and we decided to go into upstate New York at a place called Ginyange, and we decided that there was 20,000 acres of Mohawk land that was illegally usurped by the Rockefeller family. So 400 of us, with every form of conceivable weapon you can think of, went up there and retook stolen Indian land. Now, mind you, I'm on bail. And I've got a condition. I'm not supposed to be in the possession of arms. Oh, and by the way, I'm not allowed to vote. So here we are, up at a place called Ginyange, We've liberated this territory and held it for months while going back and forth to trial. One day, a car full of rednecks come driving up the back roads way up in a place called Moss Lake, Eagle Bay. As they're driving up, they take guns and they start shooting into the camp, and they grazed one of the young boys picking medicines. He falls to the ground, screaming. The Mohawk warriors assembled on the return trip down. They launched a bunch of bullets into the car, and it just so happens a bullet went in and hit a young girl, about 9 years old. Why would you go shooting into an armed Mohawk camp with a 9-year-old girl in your car? Well, she got hit in the back, and this got the New York State troopers all riled up. Governor Hugh Carey had succeeded Rockefeller, and his lieutenant governor was Mario Cuomo. So they sent up another 1,000 state troopers to engage us up at Ginyonge. Here they are. We could see them coming up this big winding mountain at dusk, and all these lights on look like a big winding snake. As they came up, we decided that we would hold an ambush for them when they got up. What we did was put on some white sheets, you know, the kind the Klan liked to wear, but not necessarily with the point. These were progressive white sheets. So we threw on the white sheets and we put some holes in it because there's 6 feet of snow all up in that mountainous area. So we're sitting in the snow with these white sheets and all of our weapons with pine branches on them. So we just look like mountains of snow and little trees. When they got into every checkpoint we had set up, we threw off the robes and went there with the guns right to their faces. And every one of those state troopers began to beg for their lives and shit on themselves and were screaming not to kill me. Please don't kill me. I got a wife, family, and kids that are waiting for me to come home. Well, there was lots of wives, families, and kids waiting for those men to come home from Attica. And you know what? It was the same D squad that went in and killed everybody in Attica. And yet our war chiefs said, don't kill him. The head of the state police force was part Mohawk, a guy by the name of Shea. He called in to Kerry, Governor Kerry, and Governor Kerry said, turn them around because I don't want Ginyonge to be my Attica. Turned 1,000 away. Mario Cuomo came back up to negotiate with the Mohawks and settled with our people for 50,000 acres of land further up in a much more fertile agricultural land base near the border of Montreal, in a place outside of another prison industrial complex, in a concentration camp known as Dannemora, Clinton, and set the nation to today. There is the permanent settlement, liberated nation of Mohawk territory at Ginyonge, and today there is a whole flourishing nation of Mohawks and children living in self-determination and sovereignty according to our own natural great law.
You've been listening to an episode of the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM. We are currently giving you some history. Today we are talking about Splitting the Sky, also known as Dekajuea, who is a Mohawk man who spent time in Attica in 1971 and was subsequently involved in many land defense struggles led by Indigenous people. We have reached the point in the story where Dekajuea moved to British Columbia, and he was very involved in prisoner support, specifically for prisoners in the wake of the Gustafson Lake standoff in 1995. In order to give some context for this, I wanted to first share this short submedia clip that gives background for the standoff. The person speaking in the clip is Gord Hill.
Chop it. This Dazzling Lake standoff was a month-long siege in the southern interior of British Columbia in the summer of 1995. I think it was one of the most significant acts of armed resistance outside of Oka, 1990. To start with, Gustafson Lake, it's in the Cariboo region of the south-central interior of British Columbia. It's known as Chipatin by the Shikwepmik. It's in Shikwepmik territory. In 1989, some Shikwepmik established a Sundance camp at Gustafson Lake, Chipatin, and they were holding an annual Sundance over the years. The land was claimed by an American rancher named Lyle James, and over the years, their relationship kind of deteriorated. And in 1995, he wanted the Sundance camp evicted, moved off of that land so that his cattle could graze there. In June of 1995, there began to be some incidents with Lyle James and some of his cowboys coming into the Sundance camp to threaten and intimidate an elder and his family who were living at the camp. The New Democratic Party were the party in power in British Columbia at the time, and they had just suffered a number of corruption scandals. It was basically like an opportunity for them to show a strong law and order stance and to kind of crush this renegade native camp that had, sprung up. So they authorized a massive operation by the RCMP. It was the largest paramilitary operation carried out by the RCMP. And they eventually deployed about 450 heavily armed officers, mostly from emergency response teams. And they also got assistance from the Canadian Armed Forces, primarily in the form of 8 or 9 Bison armored personnel carriers with the driver and the commander. So one of the worst attacks carried out by the RCMP occurred on September 11th. Previous to this, they had negotiated with the defenders in the camp a no-shooting zone, which included a dirt road that allowed the defenders access to get drinking water, to bathe and whatnot. So on the morning of September 11th, the RCMP snuck into this area of the road that they had determined was a good point for an ambush. And they laid explosive charges into the dirt road. They hid one of the Bison armored personnel carriers a little ways down the road in the forest. And as the red pickup left the camp and was driving down this dirt road, and it went over the explosives that they laid, and they detonated the explosives. There was a massive explosion. It blew the car battery out of the engine compartment, and it was found about 150 feet away. There was a massive plume of smoke. Amazingly, the two people in the truck were uninjured, and they jumped out of the truck after the explosion and began running. I mean, there was a dog with them in the truck as well, who also started running. After the explosion and the people had left the vehicle, the Bison APC came out, smashed into the vehicle. The police came out and started shooting at the people fleeing the truck. The police shot the dog as it was fleeing as well. And that began an hours-long firefight between some of the defenders and the police, who are now in these Bison armored personnel carriers. Wolverine was an elder in the camp. He engaged in a shootout with this APC, and it eventually became disabled. So they had to bring in a number of other APCs to rescue all the police who are in these armored vehicles and to extract them and to take out the disabled armored personnel carrier. So that was the biggest shooting incident. There was about 77,000 rounds were fired by the RCMP, and one woman was injured. She was shot in the arm. The siege eventually ended on September 17th. That's when the remaining defenders in the camp burned their weapons and proceeded to walk out. They were obviously arrested by the RCMP. There was a year-long trial that lasted from 1996 to 1997. It was during this trial that a lot of the RCMP strategy was really revealed. The RCMP had made a videotape of all their meetings and a lot of the activity they carried out for training purposes, because they had envisioned that this would be a very useful learning experience in how to deal with native standoffs of this nature. And one of the things that came out in the videotape that the RCMP produced themselves was statements from their main media liaison officer, Sergeant Montague, who stated,
"Did you find somebody today that can help us with a disinformation or a smear campaign?"
Smear campaigns are special.
They released the criminal records of individuals they claimed were in the camp, as well as juveniles, which is illegal. But a lot of these individuals weren't in the camp. It was just a method by the RCMP to criminalize and to further isolate the individuals in the camp. They cut off all media contact with the defenders so that only the RCMP version of events was reported. The corporate media faithfully reported the RCMP version of events as if it was truth. But as it was revealed, the methods and the disinformation campaign carried out by the police, a lot more Indigenous people began to support the Chipatin defenders. Today, Wolverine is basically considered a hero for his actions, being an elder, engaging in armed resistance against this paramilitary assault by heavily armed police.
Original than they are to dog out of the old lion from them. We can't live in a peace guard, all of them. In fact, but them and them are cause problems.
So that's some background for the Gustafson Lake standoff. Dacajuia became a spokesperson for the campaign to free Wolverine, who was also known as Jones William Ignas, an elder and a warrior who was imprisoned for his role in the standoff. Dacajuia spoke out about Wolverine's imprisonment many times, and we wanted to share a couple clips of him talking to a Canadian news show called Nightline.
And you can almost, to some degree, you can see that right in there, that everybody's in the camp by the campfire having coffee while they're shooting at one another. But the, but with that tank situation, too, and I just want to make it clear, because I want to make it that the only testimony that has come out against Jones Wolverine, Jones Ignace, is that they say that he fired a shot at the tanks right after they created the incident of September the 11th. And then that tanks, when they said that there was a shot that hit the tank, right, and that they, one of the ERT members inside of the tank yelled, "Shoot! Eliminate the shooter!" And they go and they started chasing a 64-year-old man with an APC that travels roughly 90 kilometers a minute through the bush. They were trying to run down Jones William Ignace. And the only incident that links him to anything that would be considered a charge, the only thing that they've said about him in court is that while they were trying to run him down, that he may have tried to disengage the tires by getting the tires, but that he was jumping in and out, and that they were trying to kill the old man. And the only thing that saved his life is when he went into the woods. He jumped into the woods, he hit a tree, and it disabled the steering device. That is what happened that day. They tried to kill him, and now he is the only person that has been in jail for 14 months for this, which is nothing less than self-defense of the highest degree. But we're not going to try to convince the people here, the public. The films themselves will show what happened. Seeing what's happening in the court day by day, we have a great suspicion that what's going to happen in this case, because of all of these truths that are coming out, we have absolutely no pretensions that we know that the government themselves, from our observation, wants to throw this case out. They do not want to see this case come to a decision in a courtroom, as far as we believe, on the rule of law.
Especially by the jury.
Especially a decision by a jury who would hear the law. This court has done everything in its power to try to keep her, Sheila Franklin, who's acting as her own attorney, and Jones Ignace from putting the rule of law to the court. We want an answer to the rule of law. We want to put in the law so that there can be a ruling on it, at least in some form of the jurisdiction arguments that we stood on from the very beginning. This court does not want to address it, and we believe that there is some major intent, both from the government perspective and even internally. Right, there is something in some way that people want to see this out of the way before there is a decision that comes down. I guess the only message that I'm bringing from the Wolverine to this audience here is that he states very clearly that he wants to go to the very end of this trial. He does not want a mistrial to live out of this, to get out of this situation. He wants the truth to be exposed, that you can see the truth. Part of that you'll see here tonight. But he wants a decision. Mm-hmm. He wants a jury's decision. And I think in this case, we have a very alert and a jury that is very alert, and they seem to be listening and learning a lot. I can't really say a lot about the jury, except that it seems to me that they're watching and looking. And I think, personally, everybody that is going to watch this situation and the truth that's brought before you, in a sense, you actually are the jury, too. Mm-hmm. And you have to decide about the questions of the rule of law. And I just wanted to make that clear because William Ignace wanted to make that message that he himself does not want to see a mistrial and wants to see the decision come from the court. Mm-hmm. No matter how long this government is using him politically as a scapegoat to keep him in jail, to keep him in jail for political reasons only, not that he poses a threat to anybody, but for political purposes only. He's done 14, 15 months already, and he's suffered a great deal. His son, Jojo, is suffering a lot of psychological problems from being in jail. And many of the people that are on trial are having a hard time. And it's understandable to be uprooted from where everyone comes from. But the point is that somewhere, this truth has to be brought to everyone out there and around about what the law really is. That's all we ever asked for from the very beginning, was a ruling on the standing on the rule of law.
You've been listening to audio from Nightline, a Canadian news show from the 1990s. That was audio from 1996. Wolverine was eventually sentenced to 8 years in prison for his role in the standoff and was released in 1999. He died in 2016. Our story about Dacajuia ends in 2013 in British Columbia, where he died. A fighter to the very end, he was involved in protesting George W. Bush's visits to Canada and speaking out in support of Palestinians. You can find out more about his life by searching for his autobiography called The Autobiography of Dacajuia Splitting the Sky. And again, we will post all of the links to all of the audio footage that we have used for today's show in our show notes, which you can find online at prisonradioshow.libsyn.com. The Prison Radio Show is a twice-monthly news show on CKUT. The show seeks to confront the invisibility of prisons and prisoner struggles by focusing on the roots of incarceration, policing, and criminalization, and by challenging ideas about what prisons are and who ends up inside. We are dedicated to programming that is directly collaborative with people who are currently incarcerated. With that in mind, we would like to let you know that we have a phone line for prisoners and their outside supporters. In fact, we have two phone lines. You can call us collect from Bordeaux Prison and Riviere de Prairie Prison by calling 514-876-3748. We also have a number for non-collect calls. That number is 438-337-8423. Feel free to call that number and leave a message for us with news to share on the show or an audio message for your loved ones inside. You've been listening to a pre-recorded episode of the Prison Radio Show on CKUT 90.3 FM, 91.7 on cable, and online at www.ckut.ca. The station is currently closed due to the COVID-19 pandemic, but we're still trying to air as much original content as possible. You can check out past episodes of the Prison Radio Show at prisonradioshow.wordpress.com. You can also follow us on Twitter at Prison Radio Show. Our show airs twice a month on CKUT. We're on the air on the second Thursday of the month at 5 p.m. and the fourth Friday at 11 a.m. The next Prison Radio Show will air on May 28th at 11 a.m. If you have any questions about anything you've heard on today's show, or if you want to be involved in the show, you can contact us through the phone numbers you heard earlier, or you can contact us by email at prison@ckut.ca. You can also write to us. Our mailing address is PRS, care of CKUT, 3647 University Street, Montreal, Quebec, H3A2B3. Thank you so much for tuning into our show. Stay tuned.